Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
He wasn't a machine, but he couldn't be stopped. This is the real-life Terminator. Today, we're plunging into a deep dive unlike any other, really. It's an exploration into a dark legend, one that continues to echo from the most shadowed corners of history, our focus. A figure named Klaus Richter, shrouded in mystery, deeply connected to a highly classified program known only as Soraka 87. And then there's the unsettling discovery of a hidden bunker in 1963 that, well, even decades later, just screams volumes without uttering a single word. For this particular deep dive, you've tasked us with unraveling a narrative that, frankly, feels less like straightforward history and maybe more like a chilling folktale, almost. So I'm stepping into the role of the investigator. I'll be sifting through the known facts, the unnerving rumors, and the fragmented pieces of evidence we've been given. My aim is really to lay out this compelling, truly terrifying story as cohesively as possible, try to connect the dots that paint this picture of an almost, well, superhuman operative.
And I'll be your skeptic, naturally. My job here is to question every assumption, to really push for concrete proof in a story that seems built primarily on absence, on what's not there, and also, you know, explore alternative interpretations. Because the information we have is so scarce, so fragmented after all this time, we're not just looking at what is said about this Klaus Richter, but I think critically we need to examine what isn't said. What is that profound silence, or maybe deliberate erasure? What does it truly signify? This promises to be a, let's say, rigorous examination, a critical look at a narrative that, if even partly true, sort of reshapes our understanding of military power, state secrets, and maybe even the ethics of creation itself. We really need to look beyond the myth, beyond the legend, and ask, how could any of this even be possible? Where's the verifiable core?
Okay, so our descent into this chilling legend begins, as many mysteries do, with just a name. A name whispered in forgotten files, apparently. A shadow flickering at the edges of history. Klaus Richter. What little we know, the sort of documented part of his existence, it starts in Dresden, 1920. That's his supposed year of birth. Now, for a figure who seems to actively resist being anchored in any verifiable reality, this precise detail, the birth date, the place is actually one of the few potentially solid markers we have. It's almost startling in its specificity, isn't it? Like a single point of light in this otherwise overwhelming darkness surrounding him. It suggests an official beginning, sure, but what came before it, or maybe more accurately, what didn't come before it, that's where the story really begins to unravel, to get properly strange. Because here's where the immediate mystery deepens. It sets up this pattern that will define his entire unsettling narrative. Our sources tell us there are absolutely no records of siblings, none at all. Now think about that for a moment. 1920s Germany. Families were often larger than, and community records, you know, church records, local registries, however humble they usually existed, people left some trace. But even more critically, and perhaps much more tellingly, there are apparently no photographs of him, not a single one. Before the age of 18, nothing. It's not just like a lost photo album, it's a complete blank.
Right. And that complete absence, that pristine lack of verifiable history, especially for someone coming of age in the early 20th century, you know, before the total chaos of World War II really swallowed everything. Mm. It immediately raises a fundamental question, doesn't it? Is this just an administrative oversight? Mm. You know, records lost to time, bombing raids, general upheaval, a biographical void that might be common for the era. Mm. Or is it something far more intentional? Like a fingerprint, as you said, of a carefully constructed identity. A deliberate scrubbing. What does it truly signify when an individual's documented life only seems to begin in their late teens, especially when that same individual later becomes tied to this highly secretive, let's call it special military program? For me, that absence itself, it almost becomes a kind of presence, mm-hmm. a chilling one. It's a silent testament to layers and layers of profound concealment. It just feels too perfect, too complete to be purely accidental.
Exactly. It feels engineered.
And you have to consider the resources required. The sheer foresight needed to achieve such a complete blackout, stretching all the way from birth to adulthood. We're not talking about a few missing papers here. It's a vacuum, a complete void where a childhood should be documented. This implies a deliberate, maybe even sophisticated, effort to erase records or maybe even prevent their creation in the first place. It doesn't feel like just natural loss over time or, you know, wartime destruction cleaning things out. You achieve that level of systematic anonymity for a young person during the relatively stable period before 1933, before the full machinery of Nazi control really clamped down, well, it points towards an intentional design for this individual, doesn't it? It really hints that this blank slate wasn't just a coincidence, it was foundational. Something meticulously crafted long before he ever stepped foot into Tsarka 87 or whatever it was. It speaks to a level of calculated pre-existence that's, well, it's frankly terrifying.
That's precisely the terrifying insight, isn't it? This pre-existence void, it isn't just about a missing file cabinet somewhere or a lost family photo album you might find tucked away in an attic. It feels like the very foundation of his identity as this operational ghost. His early life wasn't merely undocumented by chance. It feels like it was designed to be undocumentable right from the start. And this establishes the pattern, the template almost, of secrecy, elusiveness, and absolute untraceability that comes to define Klaus Richter's legend. His terrifying legend and his subsequent operations. He was a blank slate, yes, but maybe a blank slate meticulously prepared for something. Well, something extraordinary, something profoundly disturbing, and something that was always, always meant to leave no trace behind. He was, in a very real sense, a weapon of deniability long before he ever even held a weapon in his hand. His very lack of history was part of the design, which brings us, quite chillingly, to the forge itself, the place where this shadow operative was supposedly made. A program known only as Tsarka 87, S-A-R-A-K-A 87. In 1941, our sources tell us this Klaus Richter was selected for this highly classified Waffen-SS program. Now, for listeners who might not be familiar, the Waffen-SS, this was the armed wing of Hitler's ideological state. It was distinct from the regular German army, the Wehrmacht. They often operated with a chilling autonomy, a reputation for extreme ruthlessness, and they weren't just soldiers in the conventional sense. They were often fanatical adherents to Nazi ideology. Their activities frequently blurred the lines between conventional warfare and, well, state-sanctioned terror. So involvement with them already sets a certain tone. And the designation alone, Tsarka 87, it has this cold, clinical, almost dehumanizing feel to it, like a project code or a specimen number, rather than a military unit or a human endeavor. This program, Tsarka 87, was explicitly focused on what was termed non-standard warfare. Now, that's a phrase that immediately, you know, raises profound red flags. It hints at objectives far, far beyond conventional military engagement. We're definitely not talking about standard infantry tactics or blitzkrieg maneuvers here. We're talking about something far more insidious, something operating in the deepest shadows. And upon his selection into this program, Richter was apparently given a moniker, a chilling one, one that perfectly encapsulated his intended role, his very essence, perhaps. Dear Schatten, which we're told directly translates from German to the Shatter. Now, this wasn't just a code name, you understand, like Agent Eagle or something. It was an operational directive, a mission statement practically etched into his very being. It solidified his identity as an operative designed specifically for stealth, for unseen operations, for an existence that bordered on the spectral, the ghostly. He was meant to move through the world, and more importantly, through conflicts, without leaving any discernible traces. His value wasn't in his visible presence, but in his calculated complete absence from any verifiable record of action.
Okay, let's pause on that phrase, non-standard warfare, especially within the context of the Waffen-SS. That really demands a deeper look, doesn't it? The SS, as you said, was already known for extreme tactics, for operating outside the Geneva Conventions, for a chilling detachment from conventional military ethics. They were already pushing boundaries constantly. So if even they felt a need for a specific program dedicated to non-standard warfare, what precisely did that entail? What level of extremity are we talking about here? What unconventional methods, what level of ruthlessness, what kind of psychological conditioning would necessitate such a unique and apparently deeply secretive program? This phrase, non-standard, it doesn't just mean unusual or covert. In this context, it suggests a radical departure. A move into areas most organized armies, even ruthless ones, would consider completely beyond the pale, pushing the very boundaries of what constitutes combat. It implies a willingness, maybe even an eagerness, to employ tactics that would be universally condemned, methods that would defy all known rules of engagement, all sense of morality.
It's a deeply unsettling thought. What lies beyond the already extreme actions of the SS?
Exactly. And the name, the Shadow, dear Schatten. It isn't just poetic, is it?
Oh.
Or just a convenient label for a stealth guy. It speaks to a profound tactical imperative, a whole philosophy of operational invisibility. It implies an operative who isn't just meant to be unseen sometimes, but is fundamentally designed not to be seen, not to be engaged directly, maybe not even to be definitively identified ever. Think about the psychological impact. Fighting an enemy you can't see, you can't confirm exists, an enemy who leaves no physical trace, it's terror distilled, what kind of rigorous training, what level of... Well, dehumanization or self-erasure? What intense psychological conditioning would be necessary to create an individual who could operate with that level of complete detachment and utter invisibility? It pushes beyond just a simple code name. It delves into the core operational philosophy of Sarika 87 itself. It sounds like it's about cultivating absence, weaponizing nothingness, being a specter of destruction rather than a visible combatant.
Absolutely. That's perfectly put. The chosen nickname wasn't arbitrary at all. It feels like the distilled essence of his function, his purpose, his very being within this program. To be the shadow is to be an entity that operates without trace, without direct, identifiable engagement. Always just beyond perception, like a whisper in the wind that somehow turns into an avalanche of destruction later on. His effectiveness, according to these accounts, was derived not from overpowering force in a direct fight, because that leaves evidence, bodies, witnesses, but from an insidious, undetectable influence, something that destabilized and eliminated targets from within, or perhaps from an unseen distance, only for the world, or what remained of it in that area, to realize far too late that something truly terrible had occurred. It wasn't just a code name. It precisely described his very mode of operation. A ghost in the machine of war. A phantom limb of the Third Reich, striking without warning and without leaving a signature. This program, Sarika 87, it clearly sought to create the ultimate weapon of deniability, an absolute, untraceable destruction.
A living embodiment of that old axiom, what you don't know can't hurt you, but twisted, put in reverse, what you don't see can absolutely destroy you. Utterly. So the operational doctrine of this Klaus Richter, the shadow, as he supposedly emerged from the crucible of Sarika 87, well, it was terrifyingly, brutally effective, according to legend. Our sources claim he didn't just fight battles, he ended them. Now, that's a chilling distinction, isn't it? It applies a decisive, total, final resolution to conflicts. It suggests a method far, far beyond conventional combat or even guerrilla warfare. This wasn't about winning territory through attrition or holding ground or even overwhelming force in a recognizable way. It was about extinguishing resistance entirely, utterly. Achieving an efficiency so absolute that it bypassed the messy, prolonged engagements typical of warfare, leaving behind, well, nothing but a void, just silence. Imagine the implications of an operative whose very presence, or perhaps recent passage, means the total cessation of conflict. Not through victory parades and captured flags, but through utter, desolate silence. No one left to surrender or fight or even report what happened.
And the chilling result of these operations, it left behind a legacy that was both profound in its supposed impact and utterly empty in its aftermath, a paradox of destruction. We are told, with this almost mythical cadence in the sparse accounts, that he left no witnesses, no bodies, none, only rumors circulated, whispers of a man who moved like smoke through the battlefield or through villages and killed without hesitation, without leaving a trace. This isn't just about effective assassination or highly skilled covert operations anymore. This sounds like complete obliteration, erasure on a terrifying scale. The absence of physical evidence, no spent casings, no bodies, no damaged equipment, and crucially, the lack of survivors. That's what cemented his dark legend, a legend built on a terrifying void where conflict used to be, where communities once thrived.
Right. And this is precisely where my skepticism, you know, really sharpens. It has to. These claims of no witnesses, no bodies, they present an almost insurmountable challenge to verification. How do you prove a negative on that scale? How can anyone possibly confirm such a statement without, by definition, any tangible, verifiable evidence? It's a logical loop. The lack of evidence is the evidence, according to the legend. It forces us to question the very methodology behind the myth-making. Are we seriously expected to believe a single operative, however skilled, could achieve such total erasure? Consistently. Across multiple locations. What kind of tactical expertise? Or what truly dark, perhaps even unthinkable methods, chemical, biological, something else entirely, would be required to leave absolutely no trace? Especially for operations that, by implication, involve significant numbers of casualties. Possibly entire populations of small villages or resistance cells. We're not talking about cleaning up after a single sniper shot here. We're talking about systematically erasing entire incidents, maybe entire localized conflicts, as if they never even occurred. The strain on credulity there is, well, it's immense. It borders on the supernatural, which is usually where legends, not history, reside.
It does border on the supernatural, and yet the consistency of the claims, however thin the sources.
But consistency of rumor isn't proof. And this reported absence of evidence, it suggests not only extreme efficiency, but also a mastery of disposal methods that go far, far beyond anything documented in conventional military operations, even the most covert ones we know about. It raises profound questions. Were sophisticated chemical agents used for rapid decomposition, maybe? Things that leave no residue? Or was it meticulous, almost ritualistic destruction of every single scrap of evidence, clothing, personal effects, structures, everything burned or dissolved? or even more horrifyingly, perhaps psychological manipulation, forcing victims into self-disposal somehow, or eliminating anyone who might have witnessed something before they themselves were eliminated. The methodology required to achieve such a complete, almost surgical erasure would have to be as horrifying as meticulously planned and likely as resource-intensive as the acts themselves. It stretches the boundaries of what a single human, even an incredibly skilled one, could plausibly achieve alone. There almost must have been a system, a support structure, a whole process behind this shadow, if any of it is true. He couldn't have been acting entirely solo to achieve that reported level of erasure.
That's a crucial point, the system behind the man. But the scale of this reported obliteration, it does provide a horrifying example of his alleged impact. It pushes us to consider the possibility, however remote, of such a system existing. By 1944, which is just 3 years into his reported operational tenure under Sarek 87, the claims are that entire villages went silent after he passed through them. This isn't isolated incidents anymore or targeted assassinations against key military or political figures. This paints a picture of a consistent pattern of widespread, systematic annihilation that seems to have left no trace. We're not talking about tactical strikes against enemy bunkers or ammo dumps. We are discussing the wholesale disappearance of communities. A level of destructive efficiency that just beggars belief. And it points to a relentless, almost industrial approach to ending resistance, and indeed any potential memory or record of that resistance. The geographical scope implied, the sheer numbers potentially involved, it's a genuinely terrifying thought. A one-man, or one-program, scorched-earth policy, but leaving no scorch marks. The silence left in his wake wasn't just the absence of sound, you understand. It was the chilling absence of life itself. Of history, of memory for those affected, and eventually for the wider world that never even knew they existed to be erased. It paints this grim, desolate picture of a war where one man, or the program driving him, could bring about such absolute devastation that entire populations simply cease to exist in any discernible way. Wiped from the map. This wasn't combat in any recognizable form, we understand. It was like a plague of disappearance, a systematic cleansing that left behind only a vacuum, a ghost town haunted by the unspoken, the unknown. The sheer audacity of these claims really underscores the depth of the legend we're exploring here.
And the psychological dimension of that silence. It's profoundly unsettling. Perhaps, as you hinted, it was itself a strategic weapon. Is this story merely a description of mass murder, albeit on an unbelievable scale with unbelievable cleanup? Or does the complete lack of information, the absolute vacuum left behind, the sheer scale of the disappearance, does that also function as a form of terror, a terror beyond the physical act? When an entire village simply vanishes off the map, no battles reported, no refugees appearing elsewhere, no bodies found, no stories filtering out, it goes far beyond the immediate physical destruction. It leaves behind this chilling void of absence, a gaping, unfillable hole in the map, sure, but also in human memory and in the collective psyche of the region, maybe even further afield if the rumors spread. This feels like a deliberate engineered terror based on the unknown.
Weaponized absence.
Precisely. This weaponized absence becomes an incredibly powerful tool in itself.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Designed perhaps to instill a level of fear and dread that paralyzes any potential resistance before it even forms, or crushes the will to even remember what was lost for fear of attracting the same fate. The uncertainty, the lack of a clear enemy you can point to, or even a definitive event you can mourn or rally against. The sheer unknowability of what transpired. That might be even more psychologically damaging in the long run than a visible bloody battle or a conventional bombing raid. It suggests an enemy that is not only unstoppable, but also fundamentally incomprehensible, an entity that can simply delete existence. That's a terror far more insidious, far more enduring than any conventional warfare could hope to achieve. It creates a space where the human imagination inevitably fills the void with the most horrific possibilities imaginable.
And this phantom-like existence of Klaus Richter, the shadow, it apparently continued even within official documentation, or rather, the lack thereof. Which is a chilling testament to the meticulousness of his handlers, or the program itself, and its absolute commitment to his invisibility. We're told he never spoke on camera, never appeared in group photographs. Now, just think about what that takes during wartime, especially within an organization like the SS, which, despite its secrecy in some areas, was also known for its bureaucracy and propaganda efforts. For someone involved in such impactful, allegedly widespread operations during a period of intense record-keeping, however chaotic the war got, this level of complete, unwavering invisibility within the official record is just astounding. It doesn't feel accidental at all. It feels like a deliberate, continuous, resource-intensive effort. He was a ghost not just out there in the field, but also within the very bureaucratic systems that were supposed to track him, account for him, acknowledge his role, his existence. In fact, the only official acknowledgement of his existence that has supposedly ever surfaced, and it's described as fleeting, almost accidental, has reportedly been found scribbled in the margins of war tribunal transcripts, post-war tribunals. His name just shows up, like a ghost of a mention, a hurried note maybe. Only to vanish again, almost immediately, as if it was quickly redacted, erased, or the document itself was pulled and replaced. This suggests a brief, almost accidental breach in the wall of silence. A slip-up, perhaps, that was then very rapidly rectified. It implies constant, tireless vigilance over his paper trail, or rather his calculated and deliberate lack of a paper trail. It's as if a highly sensitive piece of information briefly surfaced, maybe during testimony or review, only to be immediately submerged again by an unseen hand, ensuring the official record remained clean.
That marginal mention in tribunal transcripts. That is incredibly significant, if true. And its swift disappearance is even more so. It doesn't just suggest his actions were known by someone after the war. It implies they were perhaps even being judged or investigated by certain factions, or at least acknowledged in some official capacity that then required immediate urgent suppression. Why allow even a marginal, fleeting official record like that if the ultimate intention was complete and utter erasure? Was it just an oversight? A momentary lapse in an otherwise perfect cover-up? That seems unlikely given the context. Or did it serve some deeper purpose? Maybe acknowledging his existence just enough for those insiders who needed to know the horrifying truth before sealing it away again from the public, from history. It just raises so many more questions than it answers.
It really does. What was the purpose of that fleeting mention?
And what does this whole situation tell us about the incredible power behind his operations, and crucially, behind the subsequent cover-up? Suggests an authority, a network perhaps, so pervasive, so effective, and so enduring that it could literally scrub an individual from history. Not just during the chaos of the war itself, but even after the fall of the very regime that supposedly created him. That requires a different level of influence, extending into the post-war era. The brief appearance and rapid disappearance speaks to a continuous active process of obfuscation, an ongoing project to control the narrative, to protect secrets, and maybe to erase a very dangerous, inconvenient truth. This isn't merely about protecting a single operative or a past program anymore. It feels like it's about controlling reality itself, about dictating what is known to have existed and what simply didn't. That kind of enduring, history-altering power is truly frightening to contemplate.
And this pattern of obliteration, this relentless scrubbing of his existence from any official record, it continued right through the end of the war and beyond. Officially, Klaus Richter was marked missing. Just missing in action, presumably. But crucially, there was no grave ever found, no death certificate issued, no record of his capture, his demise, or even his continued life under a new identity. Nothing. This isn't just a standard wartime casualty lost in the fog of war like so many millions were. This feels different. This marks a complete official obliteration of his existence, rendering him, in the eyes of history, a non-person, a deliberate void. For someone who allegedly caused such widespread destruction, whose impact was reportedly so profound according to these dark legends, his absolute disappearance from all official records is just. It's absolute in itself. It's as if the world, or at least the parts of it that held the records, conspired to forget he ever existed, to deny the very possibility of such a figure operating with such impunity and then just vanishing. This level of complete erasure, it speaks volumes, doesn't it? About the perceived threat he represented, or perhaps the profound discomfort and shame he represented. Not just to his enemies, but maybe crucially to his own side, to his creators. It suggests a determination not just to hide a wartime secret, but to eliminate the very concept of Klaus Richter from any historical narrative, to make him an historical impossibility. The profound void where his documentation should be isn't just an absence of information. It feels like a monument to a terrifyingly successful cover-up, a testament to a power that can literally unmake a man from the annals of time. It implies a kind of collective amnesia carefully engineered from the top down. Then the narrative takes this really jarring turn. It provides a crucial, tangible piece of physical evidence that seems to pierce right through that veil of rumors, whispers, and deliberate disappearances. In 1963, get this, nearly two decades after the war ended, decades after Richter's vanishing act, a hidden bunker was unexpectedly uncovered near the Austrian border. This discovery, unearthed so far removed in time from the actual events of World War II, that in itself hints at the profound depths of its concealment. How well hidden it must have been. It wasn't found during the immediate post-war chaos, you know, when Allied forces were sweeping through looking for hidden caches, documents, wanted individuals. It was stumbled upon years later, almost like a forgotten, festering echo from a nightmare that just refused to stay completely buried. You have to wonder what led to its discovery after all that time. Was it a random hiker? A construction project, a geological survey, or maybe, just maybe, an old forgotten map surfaced or someone finally talked? We don't know. But inside, inside, the contents were profoundly, viscerally unsettling. They spoke to a dark, inhumane purpose that just chills you to the bone when you read the descriptions. Investigators reportedly found restraints. And not just simple handcuffs, heavy industrial grade restraints, suggesting the containment of individuals against their will with considerable force. They found gas canisters. Now, what kind of gas? We don't know for sure, but it hints at chemical agents used for either incapacitation, maybe interrogation, extermination, or perhaps even horrific experimentation. And perhaps most disturbingly, amidst all the debris and decay, they found bone fragments. Human bone fragments, undeniable proof of a violent final end for someone, or maybe many someones, within those walls. And critically, amidst this horrifying tableau, providing the undeniable link that snaps everything into focus, they found stamped crates, metal or wooden crates, explicitly labeled S-87.
S-87, right there.
Exactly. S-87. This wasn't just some random, forgotten cache of standard wartime horrors or supplies. This felt like a direct, tangible, physical link back to the highly classified Soraka 87 program. It provided a horrifying, almost indisputable glimpse into the brutal, inhumane operations that likely took place within its cold concrete walls, far removed from any conventional battlefield, hidden away. It was like a physical manifestation of the dark legend itself. Finally, something solid.
Okay, the items in this bunker. Restraints, gas canisters, bone fragments, and those S-87 crates. They really do offer a grim, almost forensic interpretation of its true purpose, don't they? Restraints like that, as you said, industrial grade, they immediately suggest containment. But containment of whom? Prisoners of war, resistance fighters, unwilling subjects for some kind of experimentation, or maybe, just maybe, even operatives of the program itself, perhaps undergoing extreme conditioning or disposal, gas canisters.
Oh, yeah.
That points directly to the use of chemical agents. And again, for what? Extermination seems horribly plausible given the context. Incapacitation for transport or questioning, or creating specific terrifying environments for psychological torture or experimentation. This isn't standard weaponry found in a typical bunker. It's specialized.
It's sinister.
Sinister is the word.
And the presence of bone fragments. I mean, that's just stark. It's macabre. It grounds all the abstract horrors we've been discussing about non-standard warfare in a visceral, undeniable reality. Someone, or many someones, met a violent final end there, their remains left behind. Coupled with that chilling S-87 label, it strongly suggests this was a site directly tied to the program. A place for containment? Yes, maybe interrogation, maybe experimentation, or maybe just outright elimination. A place where the darkest aspects of Soraka 87 were carried out. This was almost certainly not just a storage facility for Soraka 87 supplies. It feels like an active operational site, a place where human lives were utterly disregarded, leaving behind this undeniable physical proof of its horrors waiting decades to be found. The sheer brutality implied by just those few artifact types is, well, it's staggering.
And what's particularly striking about it, what really amplifies the eerie nature of this discovery, is that profound temporal gap you mentioned earlier. Finding it in 1963, years after Richter's official disappearance, years after the fall of Nazi Germany and the end of the war itself. Yet it holds such direct, undeniable evidence linking back to the S-87 program. It raises these profound and unsettling questions. Why was it discovered so late? Does that imply a simple delayed discovery? Was the facility just so meticulously well hidden that it completely escaped all the immediate post-war sweeps and Allied intelligence investigations? That's possible, I suppose. Or perhaps, and this is more sinister, does it suggest a deliberate choice to keep certain elements or locations of the program dormant, hidden in plain sight almost, or buried so deeply they wouldn't likely be found until much, much later? Perhaps when the trail of those directly responsible had gone completely cold, or they were dead themselves?
That latter possibility is deeply disturbing. The idea of time-delayed secrets.
Exactly. This time discrepancy, it just amplifies the sense of a meticulously designed and executed secret, something planned for the very long term. It wasn't just about hiding wartime operations while they were happening. It suggests an effort to establish a legacy of undiscoverable horror, a testament to a program that knew precisely how to vanish without a trace, not just its operative, but its physical locations too. The bunker serves as this chilling timestamp. A physical marker for a program that simply refused to be completely forgotten, even if its main operative, Klaus Richter, had apparently vanished into thin air years before. It's like a dark echo, reverberating through the decades, reminding us that some secrets are buried so deep, hidden so well, they're almost impossible to truly completely erase. Something always surfaces, eventually, maybe. And all of this, the missing history, the shadow persona, the campaign of erasure, the documentation blackout, the bunker, it brings us to the ultimate, most disturbing theory surrounding Klaus Richter's fate. It's a theory born from all these whispers, these fragments of evidence, the horrifying contents of that bunker. And it leads to a dire, chilling conclusion. He wasn't captured by Allied forces. He wasn't killed in some final, unrecorded battle. He wasn't spirited away to South America. No, he was deleted by his own side. This theory posits an internal execution. An act of self-extermination, essentially, by the very architects of Sarika 87. A chilling final solution for the most effective, perhaps, but also their most dangerous weapon. It's an act of control so absolute, it almost defies our usual understanding of loyalty or asset protection or even practical military logic. Why destroy your best weapon?
Unless the weapon itself becomes the threat.
Precisely. And the motive for this alleged act of obliteration is perhaps the most chilling aspect of this entire dark legend. It wasn't done to protect him. It wasn't to hide him away under a new identity, grant him a quiet retirement somewhere, reward him for his service. No. The purpose was far more sinister, far more desperate, according to this theory. It was to erase what they had made, to destroy the evidence of their own creation. This elevates Richter from just a soldier, even a highly effective, ruthless operative, to something else entirely, a dangerous, maybe uncontrollable creation, a monstrous entity perhaps deemed too volatile, too powerful, or simply too ethically reprehensible even by his originators. The SS, think about that. He became a liability, a living, breathing testament to a darkness that even its creators realized they needed to disavow completely, to sever all ties from its very existence. He had to be scrubbed, not for his safety, but for theirs, to protect the program's secrets or perhaps the reputation of those even higher up who sanctioned it.
The implications of deletion, by one's own side, they're vast and profoundly disturbing. It extends far beyond the fate of just one operative, doesn't it? What does it truly mean for a state or a highly classified program within a state to decide to delete one of its most effective assets? It suggests that a profound ethical boundary was crossed, not merely by Richter alone in his alleged actions, but by the program itself in its very conception and creation. It implies a creation that became an unbearable liability, a moral stain, or maybe a practical risk, so indelible that it had to be scrubbed from existence at all costs, like a failed experiment that had to be utterly incinerated. This isn't just about eliminating a problem anymore. It's about removing the evidence of a profound mistake, or maybe a profound horror that could implicate the highest echelons of power if it ever came fully to light. It's about the self-preservation of the secret itself, above all else.
Absolute secrecy, even at the cost of their own creation.
And practically speaking, how do you actually delete a person like that? Especially an operative who, by definition, is already designed to be untraceable, to be a shadow. It would require an even deeper, more sophisticated level of state power and secrecy than that which created him in the first place. You'd need absolute control, absolute deniability. Imagine the resources, the meticulous planning, the sheer ruthlessness needed to make such a shadow vanish entirely. With no grave, no death certificate, no witnesses, not even a whisper of protest or discovery reaching the historical record, ever. This pushes us to contemplate the true horror of state-sanctioned extermination, not just of designated enemies, but of its own most potent and perhaps most corrupted creations. When the tool becomes too dangerous for the user, it implies a capability, a willingness to manipulate reality itself, to control not just what happens, but what is known to have happened, to edit history in real time.
Which ultimately leads us to this final, truly thought-provoking question about the depths of this darkness and the true cost of developing and deploying such extreme measures, such extreme assets. What kind of horror does an organization create that even they, its own architects, feel compelled to completely erase it from history, to sever every single tie to its very existence? It implies a level of abomination, doesn't it? A creation so far beyond the pale of human decency or maybe just control that its very memory becomes a contagion, a threat to the reputation, the security, the future of its creators. They didn't just want him gone. They wanted the idea of him, the concept of him, and everything he represented about Soraka 87 to be utterly annihilated, vaporized from collective consciousness, locked away forever. This suggests that the ultimate terror here isn't just in what Klaus Richter allegedly did the villages that went silent, the battles he ended with such ruthless efficiency. The ultimate terror might be in what he was or what he became. A weapon forged from nothing, designed for erasure, and what the Soraka 87 program itself represented. An entity so morally bankrupt, perhaps, so fundamentally corrupt in its aims and methods, that even its own architects felt compelled to destroy its most potent manifestation, its greatest success, maybe. It implies an organization willing to destroy its own most powerful weapon because the weapon itself would become too dangerous, too revealing of their darkest capabilities, or maybe just too intrinsically evil to simply let exist, even in secret. It's an act of self-cleansing, perhaps, achieved by total, absolute erasure. #tag tag tag outro. He wasn't captured. He was deleted. Consider, if you will, just for a moment, the true nature of power when it can not only create an operative like Klaus Richter, an individual designed from the ground up to be a shadow, to leave no trace, but then can so thoroughly scrub his existence that he becomes less than a ghost, just a void in the annals of history. What else we really have to ask ourselves might be deleted? By unseen forces, by powers that operate far outside the public eye, far beyond accountability, leaving behind only whispers, fragmented rumors, and maybe forgotten sealed bunkers like the one found decades later near the Austrian border. It makes you wonder, doesn't it, about the other voids in our history? The other figures, the other programs that were not merely forgotten by time, but actively, systematically erased, removed. What unsettling truths might still be buried out there waiting to be unearthed, or perhaps designed never to be found at all? The deep dive definitely continues in the silences and the gaps in the record.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.